All right, we have a special episode of the Real Estate Law Podcast right here. It's a little bit different from how we normally record our episodes. In fact, we didn't even record this one. We were part of the panel at Northeastern University's Alumni Real Estate Network. I probably bungled that name up somehow, but it's alumni who are interested in learning about real estate and people in the real estate profession. As it turns out, our friend works in the alumni office. He's some director there. He invited us to be a part of the panel. Rory is a Northeastern University alumnus of their law school, which is probably why we got invited in the first place. And the discussion was all about short-term rentals. So we talked about the landscape, regulation. We talked about our properties. We talked about how we got into this business. We talked about some best practices when operating short-term rentals, a little bit of prognosis, whatever we can cram into like a 45-minute lunch and learn, which is essentially what this was. There was plenty of time for Q&A afterward, which is really the part that we love. You know, our presentation, we've given presentations similar to that many, many times, and we love hearing the feedback from the audience members. Oddly enough, I'm recording this intro here in Guilford, New Hampshire, at Granite Vista, one of our beautiful properties, and one of our neighbors was actually on that webinar. So he and I connected afterward. He was asking about regulation here in Guilford because he has not gone through that process of applying for the permit just yet, which we did. It was a very lengthy process. We have lots of experience in doing it. But you never know who you're going to be talking to when you go to a real estate meetup, when you're part of a lunch and learn webinar, when you're on a panel at a conference. So we welcome those discussions. We love being involved and invited to those kind of conversations. And since this turned out pretty good, we're actually going to give this presentation a number of times in person. We hope you enjoyed the episode. Again, it's a little bit different from a typical interview episode, but we thought it would be good enough to put up here on the Real Estate Law Podcast. So here it is.
With that, I know you probably don't want to hear me talk, so I'm going to pass it off to our wonderful host for today, and I think I'm going to start with our alum, Rory Gill.
Hi, my name is Rory Gill. I'm a graduate of the School of Law, class of 2011. Ever since then, my day job has been as a real estate attorney, first in private practice. I ran my own practice out of Boston for about 10 years. Now I'm with Hudkins Law and Title, where I do all things real estate throughout Massachusetts and New Hampshire. Anything you can think of tied to real estate is what I do, but you're not here to hear about my day job. You're here to hear about what I've been doing with my husband, leveraging what I do know from my work as a real estate attorney to become an actual investor and a participant in the real estate space. So since 2016, we've been working on short-term rentals. We're now up to 5 that we own and operate. For us, it started off very much as a side hustle where we ran this on the side, but it's become really formalized into a much bigger business. So I think with that background, we have kind of a good amount to introduce you to with the short-term rental space, how it might fit in with your personal goals, and then some strategies on how to conceptualize that going forward. But for us, it's been a real privilege, a real way to get some financial independence, to make some good investments, and to work together as a couple.
And I'm the husband. I'm Jason Muth, and Rory and I have been married for over 9 years. We used to live in Boston. We lived in Southie for almost 20 years. Now we're in Newburyport, which is actually a little bit closer to where we have a bunch of our rentals in New Hampshire, which we'll show you in just a moment. Big congratulations to Northeastern for winning the Women's Bean Pot, which is super exciting. So it was a great crowd at the Garden. Let me share my screen so we can kind of get into a handful of slides we put together that really explain what we do and who we are. Can everyone see my screen? Guys good? Thumbs up? All right, cool. So I'll walk through some of this. Rory's going to hop in. We tag team on a lot of things. Airbnb and Beyond, profitable pathway in short-term rentals. That's our daughter, Cecily. I use her in a lot of our marketing because, you know, people love seeing smiling faces of young, pretty children. She'll be 5 years old in May. We think it certainly helps, start conversations with folks in the Zoom world that we're in. Leverage your pets and your kids as much as you can. We've been super hosts on Airbnb 27 times. I can't say 20,
I can't say 27 times in a row because we missed it one quarter. But you know, they evaluate you every single quarter, and we've qualified for almost every one quarter that we've been live, and we're premier host on Vrbo for 26 quarters. All right. These are our properties. So we have five of them in total. The one, let's see, upper right-hand corner, Cape Guinevere, was our first purchase back in 2016. We had zero idea what we were doing. We weren't sure that we were going to be able to foot an additional $691 mortgage payment, which is the same payment I have today for that house, because it was a low interest rate and we have not refinanced it. And you know, we've managed to grow the portfolio well beyond that. That was a property that we heard about Airbnb, and we said, hey, listen, why don't we buy this house? It's down the street from where Rory's parents are now retired. It's in Baxter Lake in Farmington, New Hampshire. Not a hotbed for vacation destinations, but you know, we are proof positive that you can do this in pretty much any market. I believe there's only 12 or 14 short-term rentals in Farmington, New Hampshire, and we own three of them. So Cape Guinevere was our first one. The second one is down here, Sirens Hideaway, the lower left-hand corner. Our unit, this is a beautiful house on the West End in Provincetown, right along Commercial Street. Our unit is tucked away down that pathway. I say it's the runt unit in a gorgeous building. Matt has stayed there before. We've stayed there, obviously, a bunch of times. We've owned that since 2018. It's been a fantastic investment for us. Provincetown's awesome. Rory and I, we bought Nimway's Cottage, which is next door to Cape Guinevere in Farmington. We bought that, what did we buy that, Rory? 2021, I think it was?
2021. That property was sitting vacant. It was right next to the other property that we owned. So we were able to approach the owners and negotiate a pretty good off-market deal for that one.
Yeah, the couple had just moved out and it was vacant, and a tree right around the chimney fell onto the house. So we saw him repairing it, and we said, what are you doing with the house? And we bought it from him off-market. The house, the fourth one, I guess, would be this one, Vista, right there in the middle. When we moved out of Boston, we did well with the condo. We took some money and we put that down for this property. It's up in Guilford, New Hampshire, which is Lake Winnipesaukee. It's near the Bank of New Hampshire Pavilion, which is basically at the Xfinity Center in Mansfield, but you know, north. It's a lake community. It's right by Gunstock Mountain. It's a three season town. Really pretty property. And then Camelot Chalet, this one, the fifth one, we built that house, actually. So that one is actually in between Nimway's Cottage and Cape Guinevere. Built it from the ground up, bought the land, worked with a developer, did a construction loan, designed it ourselves, and it has turned out fantastically. Like, the numbers that we're doing on that house are much higher than I thought they were going to be. We brand ourselves as Straightforward Short-Term Rentals just to kind of have some structure around our business. We have another business called Pride Away Stays, which we just launched in October or November. We're going to offer something called co-hosting business, or co-hosting of other people's properties in Provincetown specifically. So there's some big companies out there. Vacasa is one of them. You might have heard of them. Evolve is another one. We're going to offer a different approach, a local approach, people that own in the community, people that are LGBTQ plus friendly. And you know, we think that we have a lot of credibility to launch that business in Provincetown. So that's our new venture that we're just getting off the ground right now. No clients yet, but if you know people in Provincetown, please send them our way. We would love to talk to them. And then finally, I'll throw it over to Rory after this, but Rory and I are hosts for the Real Estate Law Podcast. We have recorded, I think, over 150 episodes. You could find it on all the platforms. You could find it on YouTube as well. We interview people across the country about a variety of real estate topics, including law, short-term rentals, financial freedom, mindset, commercial real estate, you name it. We tell people, don't be afraid of the word law. We only put that in there because nobody else was doing a real estate law podcast like we were. So that's why I'm there. Plus, Rory's an attorney. So, you know, it gives him, you know, a platform. Rory, you want to talk about what a short-term rental is?
Yeah, I mean, some of this might seem relatively straightforward, but a short-term rental is when you are operating a residence more like a hotel, where you have transient people coming to stay in a space that you own. They're not going to become long-term tenants. It's not going to become their primary residence. You are they're your guests and they're not your tenants. We have kind of a legal description that is used by Massachusetts here, but the thrust of it is just that. But when you think about short-term rentals, think about a broader range of things. What we've shown to you are a couple of vacation destinations that we own and operate in, but short-term rentals are everywhere. They do exist with restrictions in larger cities like Boston, but they exist in other places that you may not think about. So people who are coming to visit family, people who just don't want to stay in a hotel, people who want to travel with their pets, people who want to travel with their children, people who want to travel in large groups, they're going everywhere and not just the vacation destinations.
You know, a lot of people think of short-term rentals as Airbnb. They've done a great job in branding themselves as the short-term rental platform. And they really are the market leader. Just like Google is a market leader in search here in the United States, think about any product that, you know, has done a really great job in branding, Kleenex. You know, people ask for Kleenex instead of tissues, right? So Airbnb, people talk about staying in Airbnbs all the time. The other big platform in the US is Vrbo. VRBO is what they used to be called, but now they have rebranded as Vrbo. And those two really make up the lion's share of where people book short-term rentals. I think there's probably going to be a big undercurrent of lots of local rental companies and booking.com, which is bigger outside of the United States, and places like, you know, Facebook Marketplace that you could book, or direct bookings. But that whole bucket of sources probably represents, you know, under 20% of where people find out about short-term rentals. These days, you know, if you rented a property, you know, at a destination for you, your family, your friends, maybe a bunch of families together, you've probably gone to Airbnb to do it. If you haven't, you've probably gone to Vrbo. We do find that the audiences are a little bit different. Vrbo is, you know, Airbnb, you could rent just a room, right? They still do. That's how they started years ago, like basically renting a room within a house. Vrbo, I believe it has to be the entire property that you're renting. And, you know, we find that people on Vrbo, at least for our properties, they tend to book further out, longer stays, and they tend to be older, you know, at least, but that's what works for us. We get about 30% of our bookings from Vrbo. The rest usually come from Airbnb, and a small percentage come as, you know, repeat guests or direct. But if you look on Airbnb, I mean, I took this screenshot actually a couple months ago. I was really surprised to see two of our properties right there on, you know, the homepage. And I realized that some of this is IP based. I thought it might have been because, you know, they knew that I was the owner of those properties. But I had some friends check it out too in incognito mode, and they were seeing our properties up there as well. And I think that's because they're trying to highlight memorable properties. You know, we have this badge called guest favorite right now, which they just introduced last year. Superhost is a term that's connected to the people who are actually running the properties. Guest favorite is a term that's connected to the property itself. But, you know, if you look at Airbnb, there's tons of different categories up here, you know, off the grid, A-frames, barns. You know, this is, we were just kind of featured on the cabins. You don't have to, this is just kind of funny to put this together. I was like, what are all the categories? I looked it up in preparation of this. You can rent yurts on there. You could rent, I don't even know what a ryokan is. Do you know what that is, Rory? I have no idea.
I do not.
You know, tree houses, mansions. So they're trying to create a memorable experience. You know, part of what we want to discuss is why this is a really good investment if you're looking to get into short-term rentals, or you maybe have a lake property, or you do have a couple of short-term rentals yourself. But, you know, one of the themes that we've learned a lot lately is it's all customer service. This is like more than just a real estate investment, you know, like a commercial property or a multifamily property somewhere throughout Massachusetts or New England, or a syndication deal that you might do where you're putting in money and somebody else is really the general partner looking to raise money. Those are like strict real estate investments, you know, just by the numbers, not too much customer service. Airbnb, Vrbo, short-term rentals, customer service is a major, major factor in your success. You also have all the great benefits of being a real estate investor, but you also have to deal with guests. And the proof is in the reviews. You know, so all the reviews are legitimate. Like the only way to review my properties is to have stayed at my property. It's not like all the fake reviews that are on Amazon and Google and all those places where you can basically buy reviews. Not a single one of my review was given to me by somebody that did not stay at my home. So, or our home. So we have to do a really good job in making sure that our customers, our guests are having a great experience. Has to be clean, has to be memorable, has to like be, you know, design forward. Has to meet the expectations and exceed them of what we promise in our listings.
Jason, Rory, we have a couple of questions that have already come in. If you have a second, let me just kind of.
Yeah, sure.
So the first one that we have is, have you faced any regional local restrictions regarding short-term rentals? And then along with that is, can you distinguish between ADUs and short-term rentals?
I'll take the second one first, and then I'll flip back to the first one. But the ADU question is a good question, especially if you're looking to make this investment in an urban area. ADU is a type of structure in a building. It's an accessory dwelling unit where the municipality is permitting you to use an in-law apartment or an outbuilding or a smaller building on the same lot as your other residence and construct a separate dwelling there. So that's a type of structure in a building, whereas a short-term rental STR is a type of use. And they often do go together in large part because of the local regulations. Some of the larger cities and places where there's a more acute housing shortage, there are strict rules, or the rules are just becoming stricter and stricter. One of the common loopholes or exceptions to the prohibition of short-term rentals in those cities is accessory dwelling units or other parts of the property that are somebody's primary residence. So the city of Boston, and I don't want to make hyper-localize this to one place, but the city of Boston will allow people to short-term rental, and they'll only allow people to short-term rental a part of a property where it's their primary residence. So if you own a two-family home, or if you own a home with an ADU, you actually can short-term rent the other part that's on your land. And that's the reason I want to answer that first, is because that bleeds into the general concept about local and regional restrictions. There are a lot, and they vary wildly from town to town. As a general trend, you'll see places that have the acute housing shortage as being the ones that are the strictest and have the most onerous regulations, but it's not always the case. In Guilford, New Hampshire, we had to jump through a lot of hoops for a new zoning ordinance that they passed that was kind of piecemeal, but we were the third or fourth property in the whole town to actually do things correctly and get all the site plans and the approvals and the inspections done on the property. Other places don't really impose a ton of restrictions, but the form of the regulations vary town by town. And if this is a space that you want to enter to, you need to not only know those rules and regulations, but you also have to have a sense on the politics of the community to see where things might be going.
You said there are other questions, Matt?
Yeah.
I would add to that, but Rory answered it perfectly.
Yeah. So I think one of them you kind of just touched on a little bit is just one of our guests asked is that they have a short-term vacation home in Guilford, New Hampshire as well. And the town implemented very demanding registration process thoughts. But I think, Rory, you kind of touched on that it's been a little bit difficult, but you've been able to kind of work through that.
That person should message us. I could walk them through the entire process. I literally did it. And yeah. One of the first people in Guilford to do it.
But also, and kind of a nice thing about being in the communities that have regulations like that is eventually it'll winnow out the people who are doing this part-time or so casually that they don't want to follow the rules and follow the registration process. So we hope that this might winnow out some of the competition with the people who aren't in this space seriously, and it'll actually just raise the bar for all properties.
Great. And then the other question that has come in is, do you have any insights into the new companies like Placemaker that are utilizing short-term rentals to lease up large apartment buildings?
I have started to notice those. I don't quite have an opinion of it yet. I mean, to my understanding, do they own all the different units, or they are the ones that are the management company of all the units? I actually don't know. But I know that like the short-term rental model can work for more than just single family homes. I'm networked in a pretty great short-term rental community of people across the country who are doing just this. And boutique hotels is kind of the big hot button that everyone's talking about these days. So think about a hotel that might be 10 to 40 units right there. It's not quite an apartment building, but the model of automating everything, using technology, and treating it like a short-term rental, just a multi-dwelling unit, I think that might be similar to what Placemaker is doing. I don't know. I've never stayed in one of their places or really encountered them. But the model for how to run a short-term rental does extend beyond just a single-family vacation home.
Great. And the last question that came in is from Wendy, who is asking, she also lives in Newburyport, so she wanted to say hi to you as neighbors. Her and her partner are looking to try to decide on their next investment and are between Florida and New Hampshire. What factors do you take into account when looking at where to purchase a short-term rental property? And you might be getting to this too.
I mean, that's a great question. I'll try not to be too long-winded, but you really want to look at the very local market. It's not necessarily a contest between the whole state of Florida and the whole state of New Hampshire, but some of the things that come to mind, how sharp is the seasonality for the space? You know, if there are, you know, if it's a summer destination, do people still come in the wintertime so that you're not just paying the mortgage on months where you're getting no income whatsoever? How close is it to the actual attractions? Because, for example, the place in Provincetown, by being central to the town, it actually is more likely to book up in the shoulder seasons. Whereas in the shoulder season, where people have the choice of places, they're going to not necessarily consider the places that are farther afield. In that market, what is the correct bedroom count? Are you selling to a lot of business travelers who might just want one or two bedrooms, or is it bachelorette parties where they are looking to have several bedrooms? What are the local regulations, and also what's the hotel infrastructure like? Some of the reasons we do quite well in markets where they're not the premier vacation market is that we don't have a lot of hotels competing against us. The three that we have in Farmington, New Hampshire. There's a Holiday Inn in the city next door, but otherwise, the hotel infrastructure for guests is lacking in the area.
And, you know, also you want to consider not just the market, but the size of the property. I just jumped ahead in what we put together for you, but just to show you this AirDNA slide right here. So we subscribe to AirDNA. We have access to all the markets across the country. I believe they're offering subscriptions like that. You could sign up for it or do a free trial. They used to do it market by market. There's another company that offered the full country called STR Insights, and AirDNA probably felt that pressure from that company. But both of those will give you insights into the markets. The data is not perfect. I always find the numbers to be overinflated because I compare my numbers on there to what they think my properties do, and they're always about 20 or 30% higher than what I know my actuals are. But it's all data is relative, right? So, you know, it's directional is the way I see it. It's not like an absolute number, but it shows you, is this a good investable market or not a good investable market? I would recommend taking a look at one of those tools and seeing what the specific cities are that you're considering in places like Florida and New Hampshire, if you really want to get down into the nitty gritty in those markets. Does that answer the question? Is that good? Okay.
Yep.
Let me just jump back to this. I left this up while we were having that discussion so people can kind of digest this information. I mean, everyone always, some people love data, some people look at numbers and just run away. But this is directly from AirDNA, and it shows you a couple things I wanted to point out. Pandemic hit in 2020, right? So when that hit, we had two properties and immediately all my summers unbooked because people couldn't travel. We remember what the world was then. The next year, everything opened up again. The best year so far for Airbnbs and Vrbo's has been 2021, hands down. Okay, so the problem that some people that are entering the market right now are facing is they purchased properties in the ensuing years and they're comping off of 2021. And if they have average properties, they're probably not making the money that they could have been making in 2021. You know, so a recommendation that we have is that real estate is a long-term play. Like if you're looking to buy a property today and have it cash flow immediately, it's going to be a challenge because of interest rates, because of oversaturation, because of the prices of the properties. But we see everything as a long-term play. Even the stuff that we purchased within the past couple of years, we're not planning to sell it anytime soon. You know, so like all the great traditional benefits of real estate investing, such as capital pay down, tax benefits, appreciation, depreciation that you could take on your taxes, all that holds true if you're gonna have a long-term hold investment like we do. But you could see what happened from 2020 to 2021 and then 2022 and 2023. Those are the years that everyone bought those second homes in a drivable vacation market from a major metropolitan area because suddenly everybody could work remotely and the guests could work remotely too. So it made sense to like get that place 2 hours away from Boston or 2 hours away from DC, you know, draw a radius around any major city and go in any direction. And those are attractive short-term rental markets. Now, unfortunately, what happened is a lot of people did that. They didn't quite know how to operate them. And then the supply went way up. So when the supply goes up, if the demand doesn't keep up with that, then it's going to drive the average price down and the overall revenue down in the property. So right now we're seeing this year is probably going to be the year that a lot of people that jumped in the past couple of years are either going to go full throttle or get out. That's kind of what we think is going to happen the next couple of years. But you know, this is, I could walk through any of this data, you know, later on in the presentation or later on after this. I just don't want to get too bogged down in any of the numbers, but you know, you can see the occupancy rate popped up into the 60% during the pandemic, right? And now it's back down to these reasonable numbers. When we underwrite our properties, we expect occupancy to between 45 and 50% or 55%. And, you know, when you think about that, it's really good because I only have people in my property half the time and they're usually in and out. And, you know, people have like a misconception that your property is going to get ruined by short-term renters. And, you know, we have a small percentage of people that we've had over the years that have been bad guests. The vast majority of people are great, okay? And they usually leave the house in a condition that resembles or is really close to resembling what the house looks like when they left it. And by the way, I have this thing professionally cleaned from top to bottom in between every set of guests. So our properties today look exactly like they did when we bought them. I mean, Rory, what do you think about that? I mean, like this, the wear and tear has been minimal.
I mean, once you start running these things as a business, you're actually going to probably be maintaining these properties more than your own home, with the amount of professionals and the work that you do, because the stand every week after every single guest, you're cleaning it up to a professionally clean condition. And I don't know how many of us are doing that in our own homes.
I'm not. Sorry. A couple of the reasons why we think they're attractive investments. You know, Rory put this list together. Like he wrote, it is fun. I had to put theoretically right next to it because there are parts of it that are not fun, right? Sometimes there are guests you just don't want to deal with, or sometimes things happen at your house. We've had We've had a pipe burst. We had another pipe freeze. Mm-hmm. Matt could attest to this. We had an issue with plumbing when he was staying in Provincetown and like things weren't pumping out of our bathroom basement. That's all fixed right now. Mm-hmm. I was just in Pete Town last weekend because the storms we had 2 weeks ago, the ocean decided to cross the street and into our basement. So, you know, had to mitigate that and get rid of the carpet tiles that got stinky. And, you know, we're going to replace those. But, you know, it's supposed to be fun, right? This is a great, fun way to get involved in like an HGTV format, like where you get to design it a cool way. You get to tell people you have this great place. You get to use it. Right. I mean, Rory, how many times have we been in these properties? I mean, we sleep in these all the time, right?
Countless times. And, you know, you do grow attached to them to some degree. You know, my background in real estate and my day job is as an attorney. So when I'm looking at, you know, I'm deeply involved in real estate, but I'm looking at contracts and title and different things that are interesting to me, but this is a chance for me to actually have a creative outlet and go to these properties, start to design them, start to build things, start to do, you know, work on the weekends. And sure, we've grown a little bit bigger than that, but it was a nice creative outlet that you don't necessarily get as an attorney.
Yeah. You know, we've created lots of memories for the people who've stayed, like our avatar. Like I'd recommend putting together an avatar in your head. If you want to buy a property, who is going to be staying there? Okay. So our avatar in New Hampshire are families who stay together. And Vrbo, no, Airbnb has, Vrbo or Airbnb, I think it's Airbnb, has a great campaign happening right now on TV. I see their ads a lot. Maybe it's because I'm getting targeted because I'm on their websites all the time. But the campaign is basically like, if you're traveling with children, when it's their bedtime, and if you're traveling in a hotel with children, when it's their bedtime, it's also your bedtime. And they show a couple putting the baby or the kid, the toddler to bed right between them, and then they go to bed. When you're in an Airbnb or a short-term rental, then, you know, you put them to bed in one bedroom and then you still could stay up and play games and watch TV and do all that stuff. Like you have more flexibility. The reason that families stay at our places is it's actually cheaper to stay two or three couples with their kids at one of our properties than it is to get two, three or four hotel rooms at that Holiday Inn. So, you know, it's probably a better experience for them. And we actually love the fact that our homes have created experiences for the guests that we have there. We don't know what those experiences have been, but those are on the camera rolls and the memories of the people who have stayed at our properties.
Jason, if you guys, there was just a couple of people asking if you could put in the chat some of those tools that you're using just so they can use them.
Sure. So Rory, why don't you talk now to how to run a successful short-term rental? I'll throw a couple of these things in the chat. that I've mentioned.
All right, so I'll start a little bit, but this is actually Jason's forte. But when we think about having a short-term rental and really operating it and knowing it, you want to start with a design that actually fits the market. People aren't moving. People don't want to go on vacation to another primary residence of theirs. So the first property that we acquired was a Cape house. It was in perfectly great order. The people took nice care of it, but it felt like any other home that you would have gone to in the suburbs. And that's not necessarily a memorable environment for people to go on vacation. So our first design cues when we went in there was to make it feel like a lakeside cabin. That meant doing a stone veneer on the fireplace. That meant painting it in a palette that was, a little bit more rustic, making sure that we were picking everything to kind of accomplish that feel, to make it a little bit more memorable. And then in other properties, our smallest one that we acquired, it was kind of just a simple ranch house. So we went really bold with our designs there and tried to make it as Instagrammable as possible on the inside by choosing some bold colors, some daring design accents, things that we just wouldn't do in our primary residence, but things that will create memories for the guests that are there and grab their attention on the listings.
I put a couple of the resources in the chat that we use, like for our backend software. A couple other things that you could do for running a successful short-term rental, savvy marketing, don't use iPhone photos. Like those are probably going to be dark. They're probably not going to be, they're not going to resonate with people, and you're going to be competing with people that use professional photos. Use them if you change something out in a pinch before you get it photographed again. But like all of our properties are now professionally photographed, where we use a combination of large wide shots of the room along with lifestyle shots. I always love the coffee being poured in the mug. That one seems to do really well. But like we fully staged our properties. Like I ordered flowers and charcuterie boards and wine and stuff from Whole Foods, brought it to the property, staged things up, put the plates on the tables as if it's a full meal. We put a disclaimer in the photos that, this stuff won't be there when you get there. I mean, our coffee bar will be, but like, I'm not going to have a full, cheese and charcuterie platter, but no one's asked for it. It's not like that's just because it's in a photo doesn't mean it's going to be there, for a consumable.
And for those of you who have a background as, in real estate sales, you do want to have professional photos for a real estate listing, but remember, this is a much different purpose. I mean, the obvious things, you don't need a photo of the boiler because nobody cares about that when they're coming to stay for the short term. But you also want to animate it and, have the lifestyle photographer come out there and show people how they'll be using the property and what their vacation will look like, and not necessarily focus on, what the rooms are. So it's a slightly different feel, and maybe even a slightly different professional photographer that we'd recommend getting for this kind of listing.
Yeah. And tell them why you're using the photos, right? Just so they're not taking pictures of the boiler and the circuit box, like Rory mentioned. We use for guest communication, we automate a lot of that, as you'll see right down here, where we basically have templates that we've written per property that are plug and play, name, door code, date, check-in, check-out, all that kind of stuff that we could always edit if we need to, edit any specific ones. But I have a cadence of messaging that goes out to people, like, when they inquire, when they book, a few days before they arrive, 11 a.m. the next day when they show up, 18 hours before they're supposed to check out, and then 3 days after they leave if they haven't left a review just yet. And we heavily suggest 5-star reviews. We brainwash people as much. Like, if this wasn't a 5-star stay, let us know and we can make it better, that kind of thing. Guest communication, I put one of the resources that we use, which is called Hospitable, which is our property management software. It integrates with Airbnb, Vrbo, and Direct Bookings. Guesty is another one that a lot of our friends use, but either one of them works out great for us. And treat it like a business. Run P&Ls. We were just on the phone with our bookkeeper like before this call, running through all the stats from all of our properties. We track our revenue month over month very closely. I know how many nights booked and how much revenue I got for every one of my properties for each of the past 7 years or however long we've been doing this.
But, with a treat it like a business, I do want to make the confession that that's not necessarily how we started. When we first got the first property, it was a weekender project that we put together. And then over time, we learned how to do each one of these things to the point now where it is a real business.
Yeah, Yeah, I mean, we really learned by building the parachute on the way down, frankly. But lots of people, there's great resources online now that you could learn a lot of these systems. A lot of these things we've implemented just over the past couple of years, because I'm doing this full time now. I used to work in the media for a long time. Much of my career was with a research division of iHeartMedia. Then I was a digital sales director for two companies for about 13 years. One, half of it was Comcast, and half of it was Beasley Media in Boston. So I got a lot of sales experience by doing those things. But when the job ended at Beasley, we already had this in place as the next, you know, evolution of my life. So I'm doing this all full time now, and I've really stepped up what we know in the past year and a half, 2 years of doing it full time. A couple challenges that you're going to want to be aware of if you're doing this. Interest rates, obviously, that, you know, I think that if you're on this call, you've probably been tracking interest rates for, you know, the better part of the past couple of years since things shot up from 3% to where they are now. Reputational risk. I mentioned it earlier that everything is reviewed or reviewable. You can review the guests just like they can review you. If you create a bad experience for them on site, they will let people know. Okay. You do have to ask for the really good reviews. And the platforms Airbnb and Vrbo are very good at soliciting guests afterward to get their feedback. And you could actually comment on their feedback afterward. But think about when you book a property, you're probably looking through all the reviews. And even if there's one bad review or two in there, you might discount that as just a cranky person, because you're gonna always get the bad seeds. And people want to complain about a lot of stuff. But the vast majority of our reviews have been really, really good. Like, our rating is a 4.94 out of 5 overall. And then, you know, you can break down the categories per property and you'll see where some of the weak spots are. Like, you know, frankly, the weakest, there's like 5 or 6 criteria on Airbnb, and we have 5 properties. And of those like 25 things, the lowest I have is value in Provincetown. We have like a 4.6 for that. And Matt can probably attest to that. Everyone thinks P-Town should be cheaper and you should get more than you really get. But there's so much competition there, and we just follow the trends of what the market is going to be. And I think that, you know, price is just going up. Regulatory risk we talked about earlier, but that could always change. You know, just because a market is not regulated or has certain regulations today doesn't mean it's not going to get regulated differently in the future.
Yeah, and just my one note with the regulatory risk. I mean, we talked about it earlier. It's a real concern when you do Airbnbs. You also want to have, what is your backup plan? If the regulations come down and they either prevent you from operating it, or they just become so onerous that you can't operate it, what is your backup plan? For a lot of people, that means, what would this property look like if it had to be a long-term rental? Would you at least be able to break even in that disaster scenario? And if you wouldn't break even as a long-term rental when you're doing your personal underwriting, know that, because at that point you are taking a risk.
One thing I'll mention about liability risk, you know, we strongly encourage you, if you're doing this, to not hide anything from your insurance companies, okay? Your homeowner's insurance is probably not written to have short-term rentals in it. It might not even be allowed. If you're in a condo association and it's not allowed, you definitely want to follow those rules. But we actually work with a insurance company that is expensive, but they're called Proper Insurance, and they specifically, you know, underwrite homes that are being used for short-term rentals, right? So like, all their language is designed for that. And we feel comfortable, you know, paying a little bit extra in our premiums because that's what we're doing in the properties. I know we've had some Q&A throughout. I don't know, Matt, have any other questions popped up?
Yep, there's been a few more questions that came up. One is just a simple one, is if you could recommend a photographer near Provincetown. And then
message me separately.
Yeah. And then the other one is, what assumptions do you plug into underwriting your underwriting model? Did you build your underwriting model from scratch?
One of the services that we mentioned earlier is AirDNA, and that's kind of a public portal to take that might give you an estimate. We both kind of agree that it runs about 30% more. So I wouldn't rely on AirDNA to give you an answer about what the market and what your property might command. But the good thing is that the data is actually very much available. So if you are willing to take a little bit of time and look on both platforms, you'll see what other properties are in the area, how much they're charging, but most importantly, what their availability looks like. So do the work. As if you're involved in real estate, it's similar to running comps in MLS. You can take a look at the platforms and see what other properties are commanding.
Great. The next question is, do you screen your renters, or does the website do that for you?
We let the websites do it for us. They do a pretty good job in doing it through the platforms, gives you some level of insurance. We also use another insurer called Wavo that we pay per guest, but that allows us to file claims for short little problems. So if somebody destroys towels and sheets, things that you wouldn't normally send through an insurance company, we do have that coverage in place for kind of the small hiccups. For return visitors, we encourage them to book directly with us. So that way neither side is paying the cost of the platform, but we pretty much only do that for return guests, guests that have stayed with us once using one of the major platforms.
There is also another company out there, I think they're called Superhog, that you can vet guests through them. We don't do that. We just think it's a little bit intrusive. And I think that the people that book that way are not super thrilled. They have to go through yet another level of screening. If it feels wrong, if it doesn't pass the sniff test, if it's spam or if it's weird, we just won't rent to those folks. We turn down bookings all the time if it's just not the right situation. And we've just had a lot of luck over the years, not really having to worry too much about it. You know, we have had a couple things happen. I've written bad reviews, you know, afterward, like really disappointed reviews. I've called guests. when my cleaner is like appalled as to how something was left, I'd call somebody that we had a good rapport in our communication and where I was like, what happened? And let him talk and be like, you know, honestly, I'm really disappointed you guys left the place in this condition. Like, I would have never done this if I was staying with my friends. And usually they get really apologetic and sheepish. One thing I will say is if you're doing medium term rentals, which is a whole different discussion, it's like over 30 days, I believe, we would recommend that you do your own vetting as if you are going to rent to a longer term tenant.
Yep. Great. One of the next questions is, do you have any set of best practices for dealing with neighbors?
Hire them.
Hire them.
So
that's
one thing
I'm going to say too.
Yeah. One great thing that we found is that in several of the properties, we've been able to hire next door neighbors or nearby neighbors to do the cleaning, the plowing, the yard work. So that's great because you loop them in and they become a stakeholder in the whole operation. But also it turns them into eyes and ears on the ground. So when you're not there, they are another set of eyes that are looking after it. Otherwise, you do want to be a good neighbor. Things that we haven't fully implemented but are on the table, installing noise monitors so we can sense whether or not there's a party or some disturbance going on in the property. Again, not an audio recorder or anything like that, but they do. It's widely used in Airbnbs just to have a noise meter in the property. Similarly, you can sense how many items are tied to the Wi-Fi and see if there is an excessive number of people there. But just be responsive and be a good neighbor. And if you have the opportunity, hire them.
Yeah. And have a dialogue with them. I mean, if they're really against what you're doing, explain what you're doing. You know, you're probably not going to get 100% occupancy, you know, where if you rented it to somebody long term, they're going to be there all the time. Right. And a lot of these places we've chosen markets where there is a culture of seasonal rentals, even in Farmington, where we're on a lake. Right. So, you know, Rory's been going to that lake for far longer than I have. I mean, there are a lot of people that have a second home on that lake. So, you know, people are used to having folks that are there for a part of the year, and then their guests are there for part of the year, and rentals happen. So, you know, we're not exactly going into the middle of a suburb of Boston or New York that is not used to short-term rentals. Like where I grew up outside New York City, like my town, I would never imagine doing this. It just doesn't feel like the right spot for it. So, you know, again, use your judgment, use the sniff test, and then hopefully you'll have some good neighbors, you know, but you might not. You might have some people that are really strongly opposed to what you're planning on doing. And then, you know, dialogue is probably the great way to go.
One other quick question that came in. I know that you guys are up against the clock too, but I just want to, they had is if you turn down a booking, can they sue you for turning it down?
As an attorney, I'll say people can always sue you for anything, regardless of the merit. But you could be liable if you refuse to book to somebody for a bad reason, if you're discriminating against them based on a protected class. So just, you know, don't do that, and don't have anything else kind of stand in as a, you know, as a proxy for a protected class. But you can turn people down. We've turned people down who are just underage. We've turned people down if they're not a good fit. sometimes we'll see people, basically come because they're housing insecure. That's few and far between. But if they're kind of don't pass the objective criteria, that's great. And the nice thing is that the platforms kind of impose that criteria on people too. So if they've had prior reviews, if they have good reviews, then they can instantly book. But
great. And then the kind of one of the last questions that it looks like we have here is just kind of, which is, I think is kind of a good wrap up question, is where do you see a short-term rental market going in the next 5 years? And do you see more crackdowns or more liberalization in the short-term market?
Both.
Yeah.
We see more places are becoming more and more regulated. The places that I worry are places that initially might feel great because they don't have any regulations whatsoever. And you think that that's wonderful because there's nothing tying you down. The problem is those are the places that are ripe to have new regulations come out. When a market already has rules and regulations, you can know what to expect and know what to do. And you can abide by those rules. But interestingly enough, the town of Provincetown had a lot of dialogue in its politics over the past couple of years. But an amazing fact is that the number of short-term rentals in the town have actually gone down. So people who are kind of blaming the short-term the rentals for the lack of housing inventory, it's not entirely correct. So the town decided to kind of back off some of the more draconian proposals that they had there, in large part because it's not, at least in that town, the crux of the housing shortage problem.
And another thing that happened there is they realized that people that buy in Provincetown, it's not like they're going to rent their properties to long-term people anyway. If you're buying a $1.5 million property, it's probably not going to be a sound investment for you to rent it to somebody that might have that housing insecurity. And they kind of threw it back on the town to try to figure out some other solutions. One thing I want to say is, I actually have to hop off so I can go pick up that beautiful little girl right there at school. We left this up on the screen intentionally so you guys can reach out to us. Feel free to email any of the email addresses you see there. Check out our websites and our Instagram. We're happy to talk more about this in any of your markets, whether you're operating in the Northeast or not. We know people across the country and we know a lot of good practices as to how to do this in lots of places. And we really are grateful that we were invited onto this Lunch and Learn.